Oh, thank you. What beautiful singing.
The big 5-0, you're getting there. Welcome to the club.
Yeah. Well, I'll reserve reading all these little comments. Who wrote the glasses, Steve? I'll read all of these a little later. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. It's unavoidable that you hit 50. So 50's the new 30, right?
Yeah. It's not bad.
not bad. Actually, I'm not 50 until tomorrow evening at 9:07. I was going through my parents had a drawer of pictures and stuff, and I used to, my brother Tim and my sister would always tell me that I'd look different than everybody. They convinced me of that, and then they did that so they could tell me that I wasn't really their brother or sister, but I was adopted, and that my parents got me from somewhere else. And then it was funny because I got to thinking it might be true, because when I went through my oldest brother's pictures, there's like a stack, huge stack of pictures of him. And then with Pam, there's some like this, and Tim, there's some like this. And then there's just like this much of me. But the real clincher for it was that they, all three of my two brothers and my sister, could all produce a book. You know the baby book that you get? You fill the baby book out? They all had one. I didn't have one. And it really, I thought for a while, maybe I really am adopted, because Mom didn't have a baby book for me or anything. And I told her about that once, and so she went to look for it, and she couldn't find it. And it was her goal through all their moves and everything. I think when they finally moved to North Carolina, she found it. And so she gave me the baby book, and I had it, I was looking at it the other day, and there's like only one page filled out. It just records when I was born, weight, height, and I think there's a comment, I got Mark onto the bottle or something, and that was the end of it. And it's like all these pages blank. And it's like, but what that really is, that's just attrition. By the time the fourth one, and it was my mom's fourth, but her mom and dad, my oldest sister died when she was just a couple of days old. But when you get to that point, you know, I'm sure if I dropped my pacifier in the dirt, Mom just shoved it back in my mouth, because you don't wash them off with the last one, you know. You've been through all that. Well, enough about me. Well, let's get back to work. But thank you for the card and for the beautiful singing. It'll be in my ears all day. I can truly say I've never heard anything like that before. Yeah. All right, you should have your Bibles open to Romans chapter 12, and let's begin looking now at verse 3. It's taken nearly 4 years to get to this point. You realize that? I looked this up. Father's Day of 07 was our very first Bible class talking about sonship. So it's taken nearly 4 years to get to the actual curriculum, and the first word of the curriculum getting underway. So here we are. Romans chapter 12, verse 3. Let's look at this first phrase, and that's what we're going to deal with, this first part now, in which we're going to have to face, as I said, I'm glad there's a little levity, because we're going to lose that real quick here. You're going to have to face some very sobering, no pun intended, things about yourself here this morning, that our Father tells us when he says, "For I say through the grace given unto me to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think." Well, in that first phrase, the I, for I, Paul, is the Apostle Paul. "For I, Paul, say through the grace given unto me." Now let's just stop right there for a moment and look at that first section, or the first couple of phrases there. Just as we noted in verse 1, when we were back in Romans 12:1 at the sonship checkpoint, At that point, Paul kind of stepped out of his role as he had been the mouthpiece of God, as he was being utilized by God as that mouthpiece, so to speak, to give us some instruction and teach us and take us through our godly justification, the doctrine of our sanctification, and all those components that make it up and everything. And then he paused that, so to speak, and he stepped out of that role, and he took the role of just another son to the three of you, kind of just standing there, where he could beseech you as a brother. And that, and he began that role of the beseecher there in Romans 12, verses 1 and 2, the third party who was not doing any instruction, but saying, hey, it's your turn, it's your move, the next move is up to you, and that whole sonship checkpoint was brought out. But now you see this shift in terminology and shift in tone, where Paul, by the first phrase, "For I say," Paul once again steps back into that role of the Father's mouthpiece, and really, he provides for you a signal. And that's what that is. It's a signal that the instruction is now going to get underway. And that's really what the first two phrases of verse 3 are doing. They're signaling to you that your education as a son is now going to commence. So you have the book open, the Father's in place, you're in place. All those things that have transpired before this, all that enormous work has been accomplished, and you get to face for the first time the actual curriculum getting up and going, and this is signaled to you by Paul once again taking his position as that mouthpiece. Now, I realize that there's a phrase that's sitting in here where Paul says, through the grace given unto me, that most often than not, when that's dealt with, especially by those who do rightly divide the word of truth, who, like ourselves, understand God's program with Israel versus the dispensation of Gentile grace in which we now live, the most common way in which that is often treated is to come along and say that the terminology, the grace given unto me, is all talking about the unique, distinctive nature of Paul's apostleship. And that what it's talking about Paul being our apostle. And he is our apostle. But being the apostle of the Gentiles, to whom the mystery of Christ was given. And what Paul's doing is, I say through the grace given unto me. And sometimes you'll even find folks who are trying to talk to other folks who don't rightly divide the word of truth. And they'll come to this passage and they'll say, see, Paul says through the grace given unto me. And that's his uniqueness and that's his distinctiveness as the apostle to the Gentiles. My understanding, though, is that's not at all what Paul's doing here. In fact, Paul is already, back in chapter 11, he's already talked to us in those previous three chapters about magnifying his office. But that's not what he's doing here. He's not emphasizing himself as the apostle of the Gentiles. He's not emphasizing his office at all. The grace that's given unto him is not the office of his apostleship. My understanding is that's not what that terminology is emphasizing. So the issue isn't to think about Paul's distinctive apostleship or to come along and think about the mystery of Christ, or anything along those lines. You have to take, once again, every single word, every single phrase, and you have to, like taking that, the magnifying glass, and as the sun shines through it and you get it focused to this laser-type point, you have to keep every word focused upon the context in which God put it. Now, granted, in another context, you can talk about Paul that way, but that's not the context in which God puts this phrase. The exact context is not dealing with either of those two things. It's not dealing with Paul's apostleship in verse 3, nor is it dealing with the mystery, per se, in verse 3. Rather, what this is a grammatical technique for signaling to you as a son, or we might even call you right now as a son-student. You hear of college having student-athletes. You're a student son. You're a son-student. That Paul is signaling to you that he now is being utilized by God once again as the mouthpiece. Paul has been given not only the mystery of Christ, that's true, we know that, but Paul has been given the words that we have already come to perceive. We've been dealing with this in the last in the entirety of our sonship establishment, is to perceive the words of understanding. And Paul is now signaling to us, as the one who has received the words of our understanding, that we've come to perceive, that forms the curriculum for our sonship education. That's the grace that's given unto him that he's talking about here. Paul knows that the word to, right after that comma, is the very first word of your curriculum. Your education is God's son. And he signals to you that word to is going to commence your education, and the grace that's given unto him is to bring into your thinking the words that you have perceived as the curriculum for your sonship education. Paul has been given that, and he's going to now be the mouthpiece, the spokesman, the one through whom God is going to through his pen, pen out, the very curriculum itself. And now that education is officially getting underway. Simply put, that phrase, the grace given unto me, isn't talking about the mystery that was given to and revealed to the Apostle Paul. True as that is, I'm not saying that's not true, nor was it a gracious thing. But the grace that was given to Paul here in this context is the very specific curriculum for sonship education that's actually contained within the mystery of Christ. So therefore, Paul signals to you at the very point at which your instruction of wisdom begins. And he's going to begin speaking to us as one whom God has graciously given the opportunity to be our minister, to minister the information that God the Holy Spirit is going to now begin to write on our hearts. And that's what gets underway right here in verse 3. And so then the instruction begins. To every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. Now notice very carefully, you have this issue of to every man that is among you. And if you think about the way that's said, to every man that is among you, not to think of da 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 da, you could probably easily write down on a piece of paper at least a list, even if it's a short list, of other ways to say pretty much the same thing. But when you have words in your King James Bible, pay attention to even the order in which they come up. Because chances are, when something is pushed forward, like to every man that is among you, every man being pushed forward to the second, third word of that phrase, it's usually being done so to emphasize something. And so you should kind of, your eye should catch that, to every man that is among you. The very first thing that deals with this renewing of your mind that has to take place is that, and the first thing that you have to acknowledge is that in this part of the packet of information that has to do with your thinking, and the first things first that goes right after some ungodly, erroneous type thinking you should know is going to get brought up, and that's what this is going to go after. You should know by default, so to speak, that when in the thinking section of godly edification, you will almost always be right to assume, this isn't a false assumption, that the first thing that he's going to deal with is exposing, laying open, or bringing to the surface some kind of a problem. He's going to expose some problem thinking. So, and I'm putting that mildly. I'm trying to be gentle as I ease into this. Because, folks, it isn't just a problem. It's ungodly thinking. That's what it is. And it's not only ungodly thinking, it's, if left to develop, sinful, if we're going to continue on. And you know that this is going to go after that, and it's going to go after the first thing you have to acknowledge by every man is that this is going to go after a problem that every one of you have. Now, I'm saying you sometimes, but I mean myself as well. The first thing you're being confronted with is, you know this is going after a problem, but by saying, I say through the grace given unto me to every man that is among you, every man that is among you. That means every one of you here today. And if we had everybody of this assembly and everybody of the internet listeners who consider themselves part of this assembly all in one place together, that includes you all. That's the first thing you've got to come to grips with, is that the problem is carried by us all into the classroom. It's a problem that every one of you have, and every one of you have it right at this moment. In other words, by saying to every man that is among you, the problem is a problem you have today. In other words, no one in the room is exempt. That's why I said this is not going to be such fun to begin with. But that's where it has to begin. No one is exempt. And the truth is, by nature and by the inroads that the course of this world has made so powerfully in your thinking, the truth is, where you sit right now, whether you want to fully acknowledge this or not, I think you will by the time you get to the effectual working of all this, you do think more highly of yourself than you ought to think. And that's a problem. And the problem is stated in the final phrase of the first part of verse 3. To every man that is among you, the problem there is stated not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. That's the problem that gets stated. And if you think about yourself more highly than you ought to think. By the way, I'm not going to let go of this issue. I'll come back to it, that it's a problem that you do have. And one of the things, before you can even move on to God replacing that ungodly thinking, is you're going to have to confront the fact that that's true about you. And again, if that stings or smarts, there's a way to check that and make sure that that really is the reality of the matter, the truth of the matter. Because you may be sitting there saying, I'm not like that. I may even think about you. And when I think about you, I think, they're not really like that either. But then I think, but are they like that in terms of this? Yeah, because so am I. Now, I'm going to tell you this, and I'm not, whether, regardless of where I am personally in my education, I'm putting myself with you. So I'm with you, even though I'm a little past this, but just so, sometimes that takes the sting off, right? If I say, well, I don't want to exclude myself, so I'm going to put myself in it as well. So, if that helps, we're all in this. Because the truth of the matter is, that's true. It's true of me. I'm not like that by nature, and I'm not like that even with the best intentions of the way and course of this world. Am I like that? And my problem is, and your problem is, that you do think more highly of yourself than you ought. The problem is, you've just never had somebody point out how that thinking is in you. For one thing, I might as well make as many enemies the day before my birthday as I can. For one thing, I'll tell you this. Somewhere along the lines, you're going to have to stop thinking about the fact that the only reason for you being here is for you to get this education. You probably haven't thought about this yet. That you being here is not just simply for you to get this education, but your presence here is so that others can get their education as well. So when your life and the course of this world takes you out of Bible class, you're not the only one hurt by it. So am I. And so is the person in front of you, behind you, and to your right and to your left. You're not thinking like a body. Can I take my hand and excuse it for a day or a week without it being detrimental to my whole body? Nope. That's just one of many areas that this touches on. Well, that's getting a little ahead of ourselves. Let's get back to where we need to be. Got real quiet in here for some reason. But this is the problem. You do think more highly of yourself than you ought. The problem is again stated there in that phrase. And if you think of yourself, let's deal with that issue more highly. Now, we could analyze this from the Greek and get nowhere. But just think very commonly. If you think of yourself more highly than you ought to think, your thinking is, let's use one of the words there, high. And since the thinking issue is what's going on here and your mind has to be employed, you're high-minded, right? There's some areas in your thinking in which when it comes to yourself, you're high-minded about yourself. And what I want you to answer for me is, what is that kind of thinking? When you would call something, well, that's pretty, you know, we even have a colloquial expression, highfalutin, high-minded. What is all that kind of thinking called? If you were to call it something else or put it into, say, a single simple term that kind of pinpoints or categorizes the whole thing. Arrogance. Selfish. Pride. Yeah. You've hit most all of them. There's one that God uses oftentimes with the nation of Israel when he goes right after their ungodly thinking. And by the way, this takes, when I talk about ungodly thinking, that's like me talking about the universe. You know, what you may have thought ungodly thinking, well, that's just one thing. No, that's a universe of things. And in that universe, there's when God would go after Israel's ungodly thinking, he'd use this expression. He says, you're haughty. That's haughtiness, pride. You all are right on the, not only are you in the room, but on the target, you're in the tin ring. You're bang on, like Keith would say to me rarely, but proud, arrogant, haughty. The Oxford English Dictionary has this. It says, one who has, I like this, an arrogant spirit. When you're high-minded, thinking more highly, you've got an arrogant, small case S spirit. There's some arrogance operating in your human spirit, in your mind. That's what this is going after. Now, I'm going to say something here that I probably shouldn't say, because it is ahead of ourselves, but I just want to say it in order to encourage you, because of the nature and the tone of all of this, that there's always something going on behind all of this. And you need to, I was telling somebody at the break, you need to approach every, almost every word, but certainly every component or packet of every form of doctrine with some godly, goodly type of suspicion. Now, oftentimes suspicion is used in a bad sense because you're always suspicious that something bad is going on. No, I mean a godly, goodly sense of suspicion that you should suspect there's a whole lot more that our Father's doing here than just simply bringing to our attention that we think of ourselves more highly, we're high-minded in our thinking about ourselves, and we have this tendency, this naturalness in the way we think about ourselves to be haughty, to be proud, to be arrogant, to think more highly. And you should say, I suspect there's something more to that. Well, congratulations, because there is. For right now, all I'll say about it is this. There's going to come a time when we get down into the issue of godly judgment, in which the Apostle Paul is going to talk to us about waking out of sleep, the night being far spent, the day is at hand, and therefore casting off the works of darkness. Those aren't just any old works. Those are specific. And one of those is pride. And without the Father even bringing it up to you here, what it is, he's going after the roots of it. And later on, we're going to have reason to hearken you back to this and say, you remember where all this got started? I'm just saying it to you. Don't even think about it. Don't think about it this afternoon. Let that go in one ear and let it go right out the other. But all I'm saying is, this is woven together in such a way and such a powerful way that you can't even imagine. How he starts with this seeming tiny little thread. And with that thread, he is going to weave this enormously powerful structure. And he has these multiple tasks that he's got going on, even though all the while you sit in class thinking he's just talking about one thing. It's got multiple dimensions to it. Well, let's get off that subject now. It'd be good to do that. I recognize, though, that when you come along here and you see every man that is among you not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, I realize you might have a tendency to have some problems with this and begin to self-analyze. And you can come along and say, hey, no, wait a minute. I'm not that bad. I'm pretty generous in my spirit. And I think of others first. I make the bed. I'm not like that. Or, if anything, I'm not all that bad, or something along those lines. Now, you ought to be able to recognize that kind of thinking. Did that ever happen before in the book of Romans? Where? In chapter 2, in connection with justification. You start self-analyzing and self-justifying. And you start rationalizing. Well, you're not exempt from that in sanctification. And you may be tempted to rationalize this and to put yourself on a curve. After all, that's what school does now, right? If you're so stupid you can't pass a simple test, we'll just curve it down till you can. And then we'll just talk about how smart we all are. And it's easy to put yourself on a curve and come up with an estimation of yourself that's, you know, pretty darn good. I'm doing pretty well in the selflessness category, you know. And I'm not going to get into details. I'm not going after you here. I'm not trying to launch into you. But I'm just saying how easy it is to do that when our Father's picking and going after some information, goes after ourselves in a manner of what we think of ourselves, in a manner that touches upon a third rail in our minds, our pride, our arrogance, our haughtiness. But you have to realize these are the living words of the living God who constructed not only these words, but he constructed your inner man and knows what's going on in there better than you do. And I'm trying to make this so that I just don't say, this is what it says and you should accept it. I'm trying to do a little more than that so that you can realize, like the illustration I made about your presence here being not merely hurtful if you're not here, but it's hurtful to the rest of us because we're a body. And there's going to come a point, now it may not be nearly as hurtful right now as it will be later on, but there's going to come a point where we're going to become knit together. We're going to become compacted. There's going to come a point where where we're going to begin mutually edifying one another. And I'm not even going to tell you, because you'd think I was crazy. But there is something that God has designed for a local assembly to do that I can't even tell you about right now. I'll just leave it at that. But, I can't. If I was to even say it, you'd think, well, I don't even get what he's talking about. But what I'm after here is that so a little more is done than just simply laying it on the table for you to accept it. Because you might be tempted to rationalize. And granted, many of the schools of training, you can look at various schools of training for various professions or various occupations or various endeavors in life, get some measure of selflessness produced. I grant you that. I acknowledge that. For instance, like the medical field. And I'm very grateful that the medical field is a field of great selflessness, that some of the nurses and some of the doctors and some of the surgeons have dedicated their lives to protecting life and to the field of medicine and of health and all of these kinds of things. Firemen are trained to do what instinctively is the direct opposite of what every instinct of a human being is. When there's a building on fire, you run out of it. A fireman is trained to run into it. That has to be trained into a person. That doesn't occur naturally. Hey, I'm going to go, I guess, unless you're a... Well, even pyromaniacs, you know, they don't do that. Arsonists just like looking at fires, watching what they've burnt down. They don't go running into it. But a fireman, I grant you, has trained into him, and the very reason to be a fireman has to have some selflessness involved in it to do that. Scouts, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, Cub Scouts, the police force, what is usually on the shield of every policeman? To protect and serve. Public service. Certainly the military. The Peace Corps, even. I remember Mike Thornton, when the great Navy SEAL, Medal of Honor recipient, whose action actually saved the life of another Medal of Honor recipient. It's one of the only times in history that ever took place. And Steve and Gail, I had the great privilege of introducing them to Mike Thornton, big, burly-chested Navy SEAL to this day. And he'll stand up and he'll go to schools and he'll talk to young people in schools. One of the things he'll ask them is, I want to see the hand of everybody in here who has a friend. All these people, oh yeah, I've got great friends. And then he says, well, let me ask you something about your friend. If you were in the middle of a firefight where bullets were being shot at you and your friend was shot through the head and you saw him shot through the head on a hill that was 3 football fields away, and you knew by all intents and purposes that his body is laying up there and he's dead on that hill, and there is nothing for 3 football fields between you and him except the effective crossfire of your enemy firing at you with everything they've got, would you run and risk your life and go out there and get shot up, and he was shot up, just to retrieve that friend's body and then bring him back through that same fire-swept area and then tie him to your back and swim out into the ocean and tread water with him for 7 hours until a boat happened to find you and picked you up? Let's see how many friends you've got like that. Nobody put their hand up. Said, you don't have friends, you've got acquaintances. Because he knew that Tommy Norris would have done that very same thing for him. And by the way, when he got to Tommy's body, Tommy wasn't dead. He was shot through the eye and through his brain, but he wasn't dead. And Mike got shot right, he got shot several places, one of the, which was right through the calf, straight through the calf, and swam in that salt water, treading water with that body on his back all those hours. So I'm using that illustration. And by the way, Tommy's alive to this day. If you ever seen the movie Bat 21 with Gene Hackman, that's about Tommy Norris. Tommy Norris was the guy in the sandpan that rescued him. And those two SEALs, when they're together, you've never seen a friendship quite like that. And that's going to pale into what you and I are going to become through the combat and through the battle that we're going to go through together. Because really, that's forged in combat. And I can point to the place on the page of my Bible right here and show you where you and I are going to be going into that together. So when we deal with how we think of each other, we better start thinking about each other right, because it's not going to be very long that we're going to need each other in a way that we don't perceive right now. Even with that illustration of that kind of selfless act to which a medal of honor could be bestowed for that act, that's still not this. As virtuous as that is, and the Medal of Honor even has that word valor on it, as virtuous as that is, it's not that. Because that kind of love for a buddy was not produced by those 12 words. So I'm using the most easily embraced, wonderful illustration I can to put it beside this and say, it's not that either. This is better than that. The hard truth of the matter is, though, first of all, before we even get to those 12 words, you have to embrace the fact that you're not naturally like that. Even on a worldly level, you're not naturally like that. There is no way, as I stand here with the training I've got now, no military training, there's no way I'm going to run across 3 football fields for a dead body. That has to get trained in you. When you come out of Bud School, you have that kind of attitude. But I've never been to Bud School. You're not naturally like that, even if it's firemen, even if it's police, whatever it is. You have to recognize that hard truth. And second of all, even if you do have a measure of selflessness that you realize, or you rationalize, well, this doesn't really put me in the category of I think more highly of myself than I ought to think. If that's your rationalization, the truth is, whatever measure of selflessness you've got was not produced by the words, according as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith. That's the litmus test. That's the way to put to test your rationalization and your justification, if it exists. I'm not saying it does. But if it does, I just want to say, was it produced by the last 12 words of Romans 12:3? And that's the point. Boom, I just sank your battleship. Because if it's not the godly selflessness of godly love, and I'm not saying that to be redundant, if it's not the godly selflessness, not the human idea of selflessness, the godly selflessness of godly love, then it's still a problem, because it's still just the thinking based upon the course of this world, virtuous as it may be held. Therefore, the first thing you have to acknowledge with brutal honesty is that when it says to every man that is among you not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, is that's you, that's me. That's the first hard reality here. And therefore, the way in which you think about yourself, and the way in which you think about yourself in connection with other saints, is inherently, naturally, worldly wrong. It's wrong. And it needs to be exposed, and it needs to be corrected. And there's an element of ungodly thinking that's fundamentally flawed in all of that, and runs counter to everything your Father wants produced in you, and it has to be replaced with this godly thinking of thinking soberly, and then the description of what that sober thinking is. But before the ungodly thinking can be replaced, we have to be honest enough to not read this and try to either come along and rationalize or justify away the problem as it exists in you. And I think there may be a tendency on the part of some to do that. There's others that even though I would look at you and say, you're very selfless in your thinking anyway, you will immediately say, that's talking about me. Because you know it has to be. And if you think, well, I can look around, and we have to be honest enough to not rationalize it or justify it away, and we have to be honest enough so that we're not just sitting there thinking, well, I certainly can look around this room. And I can point to some in whom I pretty much know this problem exists. No, there's only one way your finger can point right now, and that's at yourself. So we're not going to go thinking about it in terms of Mark's talking to anybody but me. First of all, I'm not doing the talking. The book is reading you, and God tells you that every man that is among you, this is a problem for. I'm saying this to every man that is among you, no one exempt. Not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. And that doesn't mean you don't think more highly of yourself than you ought to think. And I just want to warn you not to think more highly of yourself. The issue is you do think this. Naturally think this way. Otherwise, he wouldn't come along and give you the remedy for it or the replacement thinking. No, it's talking about you, all right. It's talking about me, all right. That's why it says to every man that is among you. And that means he's talking about everyone among us. The reality is you and I are more selfish than we ought to be in ways that we may not even be aware of. You and I are naturally, arrogantly self-centered. And if your sonship education is providing you for you to be conformed to the image of God, to emulate your father, put on display the life of God's very Son, Jesus Christ, in the details of your life, the first things first is for you to acknowledge the reality of this. Don't balk at it. Don't kick at it. Don't buck it. But recognize you and I by nature, by the course of the work of this world within us, makes it so that we naturally think of ourselves more highly than we ought to think. And because of that, just as we've noted before, since this is the case, and since you're dealing with edification here, then it's here that you should start to recognize this is where I'm going to have to bring, even if it's not at this very moment, when slip-ups in this area do occur, I'm going to have to bring that power of my sanctification that I've been talking about on Wednesday night, that you got effectually working in your inner man from Romans 6:1 to 8:13. That's where you're going to deploy that. And that's what you're going to use that. It's almost like deploying troops. You're going to use the techniques and the mechanics and the effectual working of being dead to sin, alive unto God, knowing what to do, knowing the exact moment where sin would occur, as we went over on Wednesday night, there in 6, 12, and 13, knowing what to do about it, how God expects you to deal. You're going to deploy all of that against that ungodly thinking when it would occur. And so therefore, I'm just bringing this up as a heads up to you where you're going to take what's already been effectually working in you from that power of your sanctification, and you're going to bring that against that ungodly thinking. And unless you acknowledge it, that it exists and it exists in you, you're going to have a tough time with this. So you're going to see, as we deal with all this, that the ungodly thinking is totally consistent, it's totally inconsistent with who God has made you to be in Christ. And so when you're dealing with godly thinking, you're dealing with godliness and edifying, you're dealing with a problem in godliness in edifying that could be called ungodliness. That's the ungodly thinking aspect of it. That means that It's inconsistent with who I am in Christ. There's something in Romans 6, pardon me, 1-8:13 that can be deployed against that. That's inconsistent with who I am in Christ. That's not what it means, therefore, for me to be dead to sin, alive unto God, to think that way. Plus, all the techniques, the doctrine, the mechanics of how God expects you to consign that kind of thinking to functional death has to come to the table, has to come into play, and has to be deployed and utilized in order to make the kind of adjustments to your thinking that need to be made. And so therefore you can bring that all to bear to consign that sinful behavior or ungodly thinking to functional death, and unless you can, and you can't do that, by the way, unless you can first of all identify it for what it is. And that's what you're doing here. You're identifying it for what it is. It's high thinking about yourself, and you should come along and appreciate. You ought to go home sometime today or tomorrow, or it's when you, the next time you're in sonship prayer. By the way, folks, this is sonship prayer now should get really underway. You got something to talk to your father about curriculum wise now.
Well, I didn't want to talk to him about that.
No, you should appreciate that. That your father has brought to your attention and pointed out and provided he's pointed out and dealt with a problem that exists that's an impediment to your sonship education. And he's provided the means to deal with it. And you should appreciate that that's all descriptive of me, and I appreciate my father for pointing that out. So therefore, the truth is, I do think more highly of myself than I ought to think, or else he would never have said to every man that is among you. Well, I'm not going to beat the horse, but that's the gist, that's what's going on here. And like I said, it's not just merely coming along making you realize something about yourself that you may not, it's not very pleasant for you to think about. But when it comes to the issue of having read through this form of doctrine, you realize there's a benefit to this that not only you're going to accrue, but that's going to go out to everyone in this assembly. Because as I said this morning, maybe you've never thought of the fact that your presence here not only is detrimental to you, but it's detrimental to every member of the body. I don't know about you, but I don't want to wind up with an adult, full-grown body and my leg is only the size of a baby's. Makes walking a little difficult. And I'm just using things like that. By the way, Paul would use that kind of stuff all the time too. So, you know, he'd talk about, is everyone an eye? Is everyone a foot? Well, the truth is, I do think more highly of myself than I ought to think. And once that grips your thinking, once you appreciate the reality of all of that and the truth of all that, and I think it's good that we end here because that'll give you between now and Wednesday to let that sink in, to examine that a little bit, to talk to your father a little bit about that. And once you appreciate the reality of that and the truth of that, then and only then are you ready for that thinking to be replaced with the remainder of what verse 3 says. It would be ridiculous to go on to the replacement thinking if you're bucking at the problem. And I'm not trying to make a problem where there is no problem. I'm not saying that there is a problem here. I'm just simply, as a teacher of the doctrine, trying to ward off against the rationalizing away of something. And hopefully giving you enough tidbits there and enough little carrots on the string to see that there's a whole lot more going on here than first meets the eye, even though you're not going to know it for a little while. But you should suspect it. You should be suspicious of it. If Jesus went about in one of the main features of his entire earthly ministry was getting godly love produced in the remnant members, and it was more than just so that they could love each other, but it was so that they could make decisions that were based upon God's very norms and standards of what he esteems and what he values and appreciates, and that it was preparing them for their own sonship education to get underway and everything, then it's got a lot more behind it than first meets the eye. But only when you've gripped that first part of it, that you're the one in view, that you do have some problems in this area, then you're ready for what the remainder of verse 3 says. And I realize this isn't a pleasant thing to think about or have come to grips with and acknowledge, but receiving the instruction of wisdom has to start somewhere. And here's where it starts. So I think we'll let that go for now and cut this. Well, I don't know how short I'm cutting it, but I think we'll end right there. And beginning on Wednesday night, we'll be able to come back and see if there's any problems in that area, but then to come along and begin to deal with the replacement part of it, which isn't nearly as unpleasant. But I'm delighted that my father sees fit to be able to say, "Son, you have a problem." But not just say, "You have a problem," but here's the remedy to that problem. And this is fundamental. It opens the door to all the rest of your father's heart. It really does. I mean, it cracks that door open to this enormous warehouse of what your father's heart is all about. To not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but to think soberly, according as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith. Well, I think we'll stop it there. Enough said about the problem. We'll begin looking at the last part next time when we come back on Wednesday night. All right, we'll stop right there and get going again on Wednesday.